Majors & Quinn presents
Nora McInerney Premort.
I'm very excited to welcome Nora McInerney Premort to our store. Her debut memoir, It's Okay to Laugh, Crying is Cool Too, quickly became a staff and customer favorite, and it's just been flying off the shelves, and we're so honored to have her come here and share her story in person. Nora's work has also appeared on Cosmopolitan.com, Elle.com, The Huffington Post, BuzzFeed, Slate, and in the Star Tribune. She lives in Minneapolis with her son, Ralph. And with that, please join me in welcoming Nora Premort.
Keep going, yeah. I was like watching you talk, I was like, we're gonna need that to be a little higher. There we go. I'm just an average sized person. So I brought my own book to read from. And just a note, Ann didn't tell you this, but like once the book is signed, you can't return it. Because I'm gonna write something. Who knows? Like, read it before you give it to your kids. Actually, I met somebody at a signing, and they were like, I teach memoir to sixth graders. And I was like, that's so cool. Read this first before you pass it on to a middle schooler. I don't know, just a personal opinion. It's been a long time since I've been in sixth grade, but I just feel like maybe might not be the best. In case any of you brought a sixth grader here tonight. So I have to speak directly into this microphone, so I'm going to be basically just staring at the shelf in front of me, which is very hard because I'm a mover. But anyways, this is my first book, and I'm going to read from it, which should have been obvious from the description of this event, which I'm prepared to do for sure. It's really hard to tell people what my book is about when I meet them, and it just like comes up randomly. Like they're like, "Oh, like what would you like at Starbucks?" I'm like, "I wrote a book." That's how it comes up, like super casually, just like in conversation. And then they're like, "What's it about?" And I'm like, "Oh, like it's gonna kind of bum you out, but I promise you, it's a funny book. But you know, because it's got like everything that like classic comedy has, like." A miscarriage, your dad dying, your husband dying. It's like, just, it doesn't stop. People are like, this is hilarious. But it's important for people to know, or it's not, but whatever. Guess what? I've got the microphone, and I'm so comfortable with it. This is not like the book I pitched. The book I pitched, I just read my book proposal because I was like, I wonder what that was like. It was the worst. I read it and was like, who would have wanted to read this? Turns out nobody, which is why after I turned in my first pages to my editor at HarperCollins, she was like, Nora, I read it. So great of you to write that. It seems like you really enjoyed that, and it would be something you could keep for yourself, like in your journal or like a drawer or like your recycling. But don't send it to me again, and I won't pay you for it. And what she was getting at, you know, she's like from New York. She's like a little tougher than me. I was like, that hurt my feelings. She was like, I don't care. What she was getting at was the first time we met, which was when I pitched the book from this like totally like sad sack proposal. And I was telling her about Aaron. I was telling her about my dad, and everyone was laughing, and I was laughing, and I left there feeling really good. And she gave me permission to be who I was, which is like the plot of every good coming of age movie. But I was 31. Still counts. So I wrote this book instead, and it's not, you know, chronological. I think, like, you all understand, like, the chronological story that happened, but like Aaron's obituary, which revealed his identity as Spider-Man and his first marriage to Gwen Stefani, it's the truest version of what I could have written because it reflects on the relationship that I had with Aaron, the relationship that I've had with myself, the relationship that I had with my dad and with the world. And side note, my friend's grandma told me that I was a classy woman for including his first wife in the obituary, and I agree. I was like, thank you. It was a brave choice. She's been very quiet about it, but we all know how she feels. And so just so you know, we picked Gwen Stefani because Aaron actually claimed to have met her before she was famous, obviously. Like, before, like, right before Tragic Kingdom came out. Like, right before. And he'd asked her to prom, and she said, I would, but I'm busy. And he was like, so she basically said yes. And I was like, well, it's kind of something women... No, it's fine. Yeah, no, she said yes. She said yes. She definitely said yes to you. So the first chapter I'm going to read is called Where is My Syllabus? And it is... Basically, I'm like the kind of person as soon as I learned what a grade was, like I wanted an A. And that was like a problem because my school didn't give those kind of grades. I went to like a New Age feel-goodery and they were like, everyone wins. And I was like, that's not really a game then. And I still am. It's like a really hard habit to break. I think especially if you are a woman, like you're like, please, I just want to be perfect. Everyone, you know, make everyone happy. So this is chapter 6. Most people in Scotland... We're going to wind that tape back for the podcast. Thanks. Most people in college skip the first day of class. It's just syllabus day, my friend said, laying in their twin beds, playing Snood on their Dell laptops. It's not like you're going to miss anything. I know, so dumb, I agreed. My backpack on nice and tight, because nobody in Minneapolis had bothered to tell me what the hell Vera Bradley was, let alone buy me a loud quilted bag that looked like one an old lady would hide her knitting in. Ohio's a different place. It's just different. Then I hightailed it across campus with my signature speed walk because also nobody had bothered to tell me it was cooler to walk slowly than it was to shout, on your left, while zipping around to people on the paths that crisscrossed our tiny campus. I was not about to miss my favorite day of the semester. I had a routine for syllabus day. I'd arrive to class early, choose a seat near the front but not quite in the front row, and crack open my Franklin Covey planner and a fresh notebook, scrawling my name across the top page like I had since I learned to write in cursive, Nora Elizabeth McInerney. Why would you want to miss this day, where the teacher would hand you a literal roadmap to success, the exact steps you needed to take to get an A, stay on the dean's list, earn your father's respect and admiration, printed on a few sheets of 8.5 by 11 inch paper? We'd go through the syllabus as a class, walking through each of the items, which as biological adults, we should have been able to read over on our own time. No matter, each teacher was happy to expound on the upcoming reading assignments and their expectations for research papers and essays. Questions, the professor would ask, and I'd shake my head, copying each upcoming assignment into my planner with a reminder the week before that a due date was approaching. This was like pre-iPhones, like now you can just do that. I was like writing it down. Just so you know, we're going back in time to 2002. Like, we don't even remember that. But, like, I didn't even have a cell phone because my dad said they were for drug dealers. So, It didn't matter how drunk I got at Soupy's Bar using the expired driver's license of my friend's ex-boyfriend's older sister, a 30-year-old named Melanie Bolio, who is a 5'6", 110-pound Sagittarius from DePere, Missouri. Those assignments were getting done, and I was getting an A. I've been getting A's since it was possible to get an A, and I'd have done it sooner if my grade school hadn't offered up ridiculous options like U, S, or the covetable S+, more than satisfactory. I'd pore over my report cards each quarter, relishing the comments from my teachers, hell-bent on turning any S into an S+, the next time that yellow sheet of paper showed up on the dining room table. When I crossed the stage at the Xavier University CINTAS Center in May 2005, it was with a hangover and a BA in English, magna cum laude. Why not summa, my dad asked, and I flushed with shame. Remembering the Latin class I'd had to drop my freshman year when it became apparent that learning a dead language just wasn't in my wheelhouse if I wanted to keep up with my aggressive drinking schedule. You have to make choices in life. Like our graduation speaker told us, our whole lives stretched ahead of us, an awesome sea of possibility. What she didn't tell us, what nobody was telling me, was where the fuck I was supposed to go or do next. I had to start my grown-up life somewhere, so the day after graduation, I dragged my hungover body out of bed and headed back home. I cried for what seemed like the entire 12-hour drive from Cincinnati to Minneapolis, smoking the free cigarettes we'd been handed at the bar by a cigarette street team of recent graduates who'd used their degrees to help recruit the next wave of lung cancer patients. That is also an Ohio thing. Like, you go to a bar and they're like, here's some cigarettes. And you're like, I guess I smoke now. It was so weird. Also, I was like, I think that boy will like me if I smoke. Didn't work. But, you know, always try. Doesn't hurt to try. I drove my green Honda Civic with its single disc CD player through the flat expanse of Ohio and Indiana for 6 straight hours, a printed, stapled list of directions from MapQuest as my navigator. Different time. Simpler time. My cell phone had been tragically killed in a drinking accident the night before, so I was in transit, incommunicado, and in total crisis for most of my drive. Listening to Stevie Nicks singing the lyrics of Landslide directly into my soul on repeat. Which, by the way, when you make a CD that's just 12 tracks of the same song, it's just, like, not considered a mix. It was labeled Landslide Mix. It's just same song. Could I sail through the changing ocean tides? Could I handle the seasons of my life? The answer was a heartfelt and off-key, I don't know. When you're an English major, they tell you that you can do anything. But what they really mean is that you could just as easily end up doing nothing. I was confident, reading all those books and writing all those papers, that I was being prepared for greatness. And somewhere outside of this generic Midwestern college campus was a job with my name on it. All I had to do was let the world know I was available, and they'd be lining up for the chance to show me what was next. After all, this was the heyday of Jessica Simpson on Newlyweds, of Paris Hilton and Laguna Beach. Success, it seemed, was just a given if you were a moderately attractive white girl with blonde hair and no shame. To the credit of the world, who eventually lost interest in all three of those things, that was not exactly the case. The world was not waiting for another blonde white girl whose interests were lots of things, and whose stated goal on her resume was to get a job with name of company. I envied the friends who were so certain of their futures, the ones who graduated with a degree in marketing and went to work for GE or P&G or any other company that goes by just its initials. Or graduated with degrees in biology and moved on to medical school, or with degrees in political science and moved on to law school. I bought an LSAT book, but I kept falling asleep in my own lawn chair every time I opened it. I had considered business school, but then I realized that you need to take a test to get in and decide the first test of business school is knowing you need to take a test to get in. And I'd failed. I still bought a GMAT book, and then I realized that taking math for athletes with the entire basketball team hadn't exactly prepared me for the rigors of business school. I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. I was waiting for somebody to tell me, but nobody did. But nobody told me to move to Italy after graduation and take a lazy summer as an au pair while my classmates rushed off to jobs managing rental car franchises in a big old hurry to be grown-ups with rent and car payments. I didn't get explicit instructions on how to move to New York City, though I hoped that if I had, they would have advised me to have more than $400 in my bank account and to maybe have a job lined up before arriving with my two suitcases and a dream like Fievel Moskowitz. Even he had, like, a family like to fall back on. And that voice. I didn't know how to be single, and I sucked at it, but somehow that got me to Aaron, and I got to fall in love the way I once fell down the stairs at a movie theater, hard and publicly with just a little bit of rug burn. There was no roadmap for me to follow when my phone rang and Aaron was having a seizure at work, or when the reason for the season, it's his favorite joke, guys, you really gotta laugh at that one, turned out to be a brain tumor, which turned out to be the gnarliest form of brain cancer there is. Aaron and I made it up as we went along. We got married, we had a baby, we traveled and went to concerts, and sometimes got caught by the nurses getting just a little too friendly in his hospital bed. His mom's here, so this feels comfortable. This is not to say that I didn't have doubts, because I did. I was sure all the time that I was doing it wrong. I spent a lot of time looking up for my life and craning my neck around to get a glimpse at everyone else's paper. How were they adulting, and were they doing it better than me? Should I be buying a house in the Midwest instead of renting in Brooklyn? Should I be getting an MBA, or at least, like, marrying someone who has one? Am I taking good enough care of Aaron? Is it okay that I'm still working while he's sick, even though he tells me I should? Should I maybe have not left my full-time job when my husband died? I thought I was ready to say goodbye to Aaron. It's okay, I told him. I'll be okay. After 3 years of chemo and radiation, every labored breath was truly work for his body. The pain of a brain tumor was so immense that he was on a list of narcotics I'd only heard about drug addicts using. And during his 2 weeks of hospice, he'd slipped slowly from my side into a quiet, unconscious limbo between this world and the next. The moment he was gone, I wasn't ready anymore, and I was filled with a crippling sense of doubt. Was I good enough for you? Did I make this easy enough? Why did I get mad at you for forgetting garbage day? And what the fuck do I do now? At 22, with an expensive degree and no plan for my life, I felt like a fucking loser. At 32, with an expensive degree, a mortgage, a child, and no plan for my life, I feel like a fucking genius. Somewhere in those past 10 years, I became, against all odds, an adult. Emails started arriving in my inbox from recent graduates with dreams of working in PR and marketing. Aim higher. don't do it. asking me what I thought they should do. Something else. My 16-year-old neighbor burst through my back door with her finger wrapped in a pile of bloody paper towels after slicing it open, trying to have a bagel. My response to both situations was an internal, "Why are you talking to me?" And then it hit me. They think I'm an adult. Oh, shit, I am an adult. I somehow bandaged up the girl next door and got her finger to stop gushing blood on my granite countertops, and I replied to nearly every email I got from younger women looking for advice. But I told them all the same thing. I have no idea what I'm doing, and it's okay if you don't either. I know that I will never be ready to be an adult, that nobody will ever give me the proper instructions, and even if they did, I'd treat them like I do maps or IKEA manuals and just wing it. I once put a chair together backwards. How is that even possible? Like, you should just be able to turn it. It wasn't possible. They were like, "You broke it. You don't actually get a refund." I was like, "I'll leave with this chair." And the instructions were in my garbage. Good day. Being an adult is doing everything before you are ready. It's having the guts or the blind stupidity to take your own route and make it up as you go. I was never going to move to Cleveland and stay at home with my two children while my banker husband brought home the organic nitrate-free bacon. I was never going to be a lawyer or an MBA, though all three of those are fine things to be. I was always meant to find my own weird little path in life, no matter how many years I spent following the one laid out for me. I still sometimes feel that gnawing feeling that I'm doing it wrong, that I should be more like my friends with normal jobs and normal lives, but I know that the voice inside me is sometimes an idiot, because that voice is the same one that convinced me to get the Reese Witherspoon Sweet Home Alabama haircut. It's also a moment in time for women my age. Even though I'm 6 feet tall with a weak chin, and I looked like a brontosaurus and not like a little, I didn't look like Reese Witherspoon. Okay, I was like, is anyone convinced? And everyone was like, we aren't, please. Take a vitamin. I don't know what is next, and that's okay. It's more than okay because I actually get to decide what it is. I can keep inventing this life as I go, creating the world I want for myself and my son, showing him that life is best when you live it yourself rather than waiting for someone to show you how it's done. There is no syllabus for life that outlines the steps you need to take to graduate to the next event. This life itself is the lesson and the test, and there is no dean's list and no gold stars. There's just the sum of your relationships and your actions, measured by how you feel when you lie down to go to sleep at night and how many people heart your tweets. I never thought I'd say this, but fuck syllabus day. That's the end of that chapter. I feel like you shouldn't clap between them. Just personal opinion. But if you want to, like, I can't stop you, unless I can. Okay, this next chapter is, okay, so this is something that, like, is very hard for people to talk about, but I did not know growing up that, like, having a baby might be harder than it looks, and it's, like, super sensitive. Like, there's, like, so many people, like, now I'm, like, so aware of it that it's, like, hard to have a baby, or, like, maybe it just, like, doesn't happen at all, and it's, like, a major bummer for people, and I didn't realize that until it happened to me. So I tell everybody how Ralph came to be in this world, which is science. Because I don't know, I just feel like it's important to say, because somebody else is, like, sitting there like, oh, like, you had a baby. I'm like, trust me, I worked for it. And not, like, the fun way. Like, I was, like, just laying on my back. Just, I guess that happens too. But in a doctor's office being like, I have a meeting in, like, 30 minutes. Do you think I'll make it? Okay, so this one is called Immaculate Conception. I took my first pregnancy test when I was 16. In the bathroom of a Walgreens 6 miles away from my parents' house. There was a Walgreens a half mile away, but buying a pregnancy test literally in the shadow of my Catholic grade school was too risky. I was guaranteed to be seen by someone's mom or brother, even if I tried to conceal the telltale box with 17 magazine and some 2-for-1 M&Ms. So instead, I drove my mother's lime green VW Beetle to the nearest suburb, a hot pink plastic Gerbera Daisy bobbing its head in the dashboard bud vase. This was 1999, before every child was born with an iPhone in its hand, so I had nothing to do but wait with my own thoughts for every agonizing minute until the test decided my fate. How would I tell my parents, I wondered. How would everyone react? How rare exactly was it for a virgin to get pregnant besides Jesus' mom? To my shock and delight, my test was negative. Probably, although I'm not going to pretend to be some kind of medical professional, so this is not considered medical advice, because I was a virgin. Most virgins aren't extremely concerned about unplanned pregnancies, but our friend's mother, who is a registered nurse, had recently given us all a real cold shower of a talk. She swore up and down she'd just delivered twin babies to a 15-year-old mother in St. Paul who was a virgin. A virgin, okay? Her patient had thought she was safe as long as she didn't have penis-vagina sex, but she learned the hard way that nope, that was not the case, and she wished she had stopped at just kissing. Typing this story out now, I realized that Justin's mom was just trying to keep us innocent and prevent her son from becoming a teenage father, but instead she drove me to an obsessive belief that I was always pregnant. Always. I was like, oh, I did kiss that boy. Twice. After scrutinizing the results for approximately 10 minutes to make sure I hadn't misread them, I was satisfied with the veracity of the test. I wrapped the little plastic wand in about 6 pounds of toilet paper and buried it in the garbage can, hoping it couldn't be traced back to me in any way should a curious custodian happen to see the vague outline of a pregnancy test through the garbage bag, and, surmising it had come from a wayward youth, decided to call the cops, who would immediately run DNA testing on it and then find my parents and tell them their daughter was a grade A slut. You can't be too careful. Not in 1999. My mother probably deserves some of the blame for this hysteria. She's not here, so just blame her. If only because I like to blame her for most things in my life. She'd told me and my first boyfriend, who she once caught kissing on the couch after school, that if we had sex, we would without a doubt get pregnant. I've had 4 kids, she told him as he contemplated jumping out of our dining room window. And both of Nora's grandmothers had 9. 9. She comes from a long line of fertile women. Like you're 16. Like, don't say fertile. Don't say woman. Well. I wasn't going to take any chances, so I started birth control before I even started having sex, just in case, and still anxiously awaited the arrival of my period every single month. Poor teenage Nora would be relieved, sad, confused to know that I didn't eventually get pregnant from kissing. I didn't even get pregnant from having sex. I got pregnant from science. After Aaron's diagnosis, right before he started treatment, I asked Aaron's oncology nurse about having babies. They'd already cautioned us against unprotected sex, or as they sensually described it, the exchange of bodily fluids, whatever they may be. And I could hear her shift uncomfortably on the other end of the phone before telling me how unpredictable and challenging the disease would be for him. But that's not what I called to hear, so I asked again, and she recommended that he take a visit to a nearby cryogenics lab before he began radiation and chemotherapy. While it sounds extremely fancy, a cryogenics lab is just a fancy term for sperm bank, which is just a fancy term for a battered, vaguely medical office in a suburban strip mall. This particular one was wedged between a closed bookstore and an insurance office. The lab was a perfect example of just how misleading a website can be. There are no perfectly polished and smiling nurses in lab coats, no handsome and eligible young Ivy Leaguers in the waiting room waiting to donate some sperm to a couple in need. Just a red-eyed guy with a breakfast Mountain Dew who takes your insurance information, and a few weathered and meth-faced guys in beat-up Caprices in the parking lot who I would pay to keep their sperm away from my vagina. Aaron had a half dozen doctor's appointments that week, 100 ways for them to poke and prick and examine him before they treated him, but he still woke up at 7 to jerk off in a strip mall closet so we could have a family someday. Hi, Kim. That's love. I once saw the nurse who got me pregnant while I was standing in line at the airport. It took me a while to place her, which I hate because I'd like to think I could quickly name all the people who have ever seen my vagina. But let's be realistic. Let alone the number of people who have inserted a small syringe of sperm into it. That syringe of sperm had ended up turning into a positive pregnancy test that had turned out to be Ralph, who's now sitting like a prince in an expensive running stroller with his own ticket to Arizona, earning miles on his own frequent flyer account. All right, I'd said to her on that April morning, 2.5 years ago, spreading my legs and closing my eyes. Go ahead and get me pregnant. I'd kissed Aaron goodbye that morning and let him sleep off the chemo while I headed off to be inseminated before starting my workday. She nailed it. I was totally pregnant, and it was all thanks to her and to the pregnancy pact I made with my two childhood friends. Never doubt the power of a pinky swear made at a wedding reception when you're all kind of buzzed. I had always planned to send my nurse a thank you card for impregnating me, in which I said all the right things and thanked her for her hand in creating the small human whose dragon breath wakes me up every morning with a terrible smelling but achingly sincere, "I love you, Mama." Breathed directly into my face and followed with a wet, open mouth kiss. But it turns out that card doesn't yet exist. And no matter how I tried to catch her eye as we wound through an endless TSA line, I couldn't make it happen. I also couldn't remember her first name, so I didn't know what to yell, and like, "Hey, you got me pregnant," seemed a little too aggressive for the setting. So instead, I will consider this paragraph my thank you card and hope she reads it in the break room while she rests between impregnating other women and making their dreams come true. I also hope that my friend's mom is reading this because she was right. You can get pregnant without having sex. It's just going to cost you a little more than dry humping your boyfriend in the front seat of his parents' Lincoln. And it will involve a series of strangers becoming very intimate with your swimsuit zone. The medical community calls it IUI, but I call it Immaculate Conception because it's a fucking miracle. And that's that one. Is there any like chapter anyone really wants me to read? Because I have them all marked. No? Okay, whatever. I hate audience participation too. It's like the worst. Wait till I call in all of you. Just say something nice about me. You. What was your favorite part? Okay, this chapter is about how people like try to say nice things to you, but then it's like super insulting. And it's like all in like the title, which is like how you do it. And it's like people love to say to you, like, "How do you do it?" And it's like vaguely insulting. It's like saying to somebody, like, "Your life is so shitty. I can't imagine doing it. I just wouldn't. Oof. Not me." It's like, cool. I am alive still. So I am living that life that you would not be able to do. So just, you know, I think it's just like a casual thing that people say to like fill the silence, but it's like super, if you really think about it, it's kind of like telling somebody like everything happens for a reason, which is like, that's mean. Like everything happens for a reason. Like your husband's dead. Can't you wait to find out why? Okay. I don't know how you do it, people say. I wouldn't be able to get out of bed in the morning. It's meant as a compliment. I must be so strong. And it's nice to hear that people may think of me that way, but it's not exactly true. I'm not stronger than anybody. I mean, like, physically, yes, I can do 3 pull-ups, so I'm stronger than some people. But emotionally, I'm the same as anyone else. Because this strength isn't superhuman. It's the most human thing of all. A muscle we're all born with, but need to exercise rarely at best. And lucky for us, it's a tenacious little thing that bounces back from atrophy as soon as you need to flex it. While we're talking about muscles, I do work out, thanks for asking. At one of those gyms that's filled with giant, heavy weights and ultra-fit humans and not much else. Working out is hard for me because I am naturally lazy and like to take the easy way out. So, like, sometimes I'll skip around if I have lunch plans after class and don't want to sweat too much. If I can't get in a full set of push-ups, I just cut myself a break. 7 is basically 10. One day, while I was complaining about how heavy the kettlebells were, my coach agreed with me. The workout was hard. "That's the thing," he said. "To get stronger, things have to get harder." So both my shoulders and my inner strength are more developed now than they were a few years ago, Because even though I do try to half-ass it through push-ups, and I got through most of my life with just zero problems, I've now been through some shit. And someday, you will too. Maybe you won't lift weights, although it is recommended to keep our bone density up, ladies. Men, I don't know what you're supposed to do. You're on your own. But something hard is going to happen to you. Your husband may get sick. Your parents have a 100% chance of dying. And I don't mean it as a scare tactic. I mean it as a pep talk. Because someday the universe will throw a wrench in the works and your well-oiled machine of a life will grind to a halt. And then it will keep going. Because after you got bored of crying and worrying, you took a deep breath and pushed it back into motion. I don't know how you do it, someone will say to you while softly touching your arm in like an NPR voice that they just got for you. But you'll know it's really nothing special to keep one foot moving after the other. You do it reflexively, like breathing, because it's not something you can choose not to do. The world goes on, even when you wish it would just lay on the bathroom floor with you for a little while. Your water bill still needs to be paid. They're adding your favorite shows from the 90s to Netflix. And your child insists on waking up and eating breakfast every day, just daily. You're like, I thought we already did that. Oh, it was yesterday. So you do what needs to be done. You get through it. The way Britney got through 2007 and made it a distant memory and an internet meme. The way Reese Witherspoon got through her divorce with Ryan Phillippe when he was super hot, and now everyone's like, who's Ryan Phillippe? You're like Googling it. The way Jackie Kennedy got through picking up pieces of her husband's brain and then married a Greek bajillionaire. The way Beyonce got through the dismantling of Destiny's Child and emerged as Beyonce. The way Khaleesi emerged from the fire and became the mother of dragons. It's a Game of Thrones reference. If you haven't watched it, I ruined it for you. And also, like, what have you been doing? Like, that's not my fault. That's, like, you not participating in pop culture. You can't be mad at me. Be mad at yourself, is what I'm saying. You won't do it because you're Superwoman. You'll do it because it's your life, and there's nobody who can live it for you. You'll do it because you come from a long line of strong women. Women like Britney and Reese and Jackie. Women like Beyonce. Women like your mom, who pushed you out of her vagina or picked you out of the whole world to love you and raise you up. Women like you, unless you're a man, in which case just imagine a woman you admire and be like her. It was the middle of a normal Monday when Aaron had a seizure that turned out to be a brain tumor, that turned out to be brain cancer, that turned out to kill him. I'd woken up a normal 27-year-old woman who still had her hangover from Saturday night. And somewhere along the way, probably when I was passed out, my life had been tilted on its side without my permission. I was not pleased. I had a very important PowerPoint to finish. I worked in advertising. I needed people to click on internet ads and buy things. I made my mother drive me to the hospital, and I could feel my heart beating through my chest the entire 3-mile ride from downtown to South Minneapolis. My mother had things to do at work, advertising. So she pulled up to the emergency room, leaned over me to open the door, and all but pushed me out of the car. "Go in there and be a woman," she said. And even though I had no idea what she meant, that's what I did. That's really? Whew. Okay, I'll see. I'll see how many pages long that is. That's a good one. Thank you. It's a dad one. just scrolling through my own chapter. I was like, where is that one? Five. You didn't understand it? Okay, here we go. Well, I guess I did a great job on that chapter. All right. This chapter made me nervous because it was like about a story my dad told me. And then I was like, what was it again? Which is like, he told it to us our whole lives. And we were like, and all my siblings were like, well, you know, it's like, the way it starts, they're like, you take the message to Garcia. Like, that's the whole story. And I was like, I feel like there was more. And it was usually yelled at us. And so it just sounded like, you know, the parents and like Charlie Brown. So this is about my dad, Steve. Steve had high expectations for his 4 children. And why wouldn't he? Before he'd even turned 21, he'd spent several years as a Marine, served in a war, and become an accomplished alcoholic. Stand up straight, he'd bark, slapping me on the back just between my shoulder blades. Roll those shoulders back and put them in their pockets. I can't imagine that last part being a Marine phrase, but I still repeat it to every sloucher I see because poor posture really is such an unattractive trait. In addition to disapproving of bad posture, Steve wasn't much for excuses either. You need to take the message to Garcia, he'd insist, when we offered up reasons for not returning our rental videos on time, for not mowing the lawn or unloading the dishwasher or completing our homework. What does that even mean? We'd whine as he thrust a plastic bag into our hands and pushed us out the door toward the piles of dog shit that had accumulated in the yard while we were too busy studying to clean up after the dog we'd sworn we'd take care of. It means, he said, that when something needs to be done, you goddamn do it. That's like another Marine slash dad thing, I think, like placing swears in awkward places where they don't exist. No matter what our excuses were, my father's answer was always the same. My bike tires are out of air, so I can't bike to work. Take the message to Garcia. I gotta see because my teacher hates me. Take the message to Garcia. I think my arm is broken. Take the message to Garcia. My siblings and I still love this phrase, even if we were never really sure where it came from. Not because my dad didn't explain its origins, but because he explained it to us so many times, we just took it for granted that he'd always be there to try to drill a life lesson into us. So here's the Cliff's Notes version, and by Cliff's Notes, I mean Wikipedia. America's about to get into war with Spain, and President McKinley needs to get a message to General Garcia in Cuba because, like, he just does. Anyway, McKinley's sitting around wondering, how are they going to get this message to Garcia in Cuba? He can't think of anyone to take it. Kind of imagine him, like, looking around a table full of guys who are avoiding eye contact and hoping they don't get called on until his eyes lock with a young guy named Lieutenant Rowan, and it becomes immediately obvious, this is the guy. He will take the message to Garcia. I know this isn't actually how it actually happened, history buffs, but relax. I'm telling a story and using Wikipedia in place of my dad. So Rowan takes the message to Garcia. That's the entire point, the whole point of the story, okay? He doesn't ask, as my dad pointed out to me every time I tried to claim I didn't know how to start the lawnmower, and I still don't, how to get there. He didn't ask why he had to take the message. This is kind of a heavy concept to get through your thick skull when you're young and stupid and want to watch MTV and paint your nails, but damn, Steve had a point. Because I do have a bad habit of not taking the message to Garcia, but like instead just saving the message to Garcia as a draft and forgetting about it for like 7 to 10 days or weeks or months. And I have my excuses or reasons. For one, I'm really tired. I didn't get a ton of sleep last night because I was up too late watching Orange is the New Black, and my phone died, and I recently lost all my contacts, and something came up at the last minute, and I didn't have a babysitter, so I couldn't make it. Also, I just lost 2 hours of my life going down an Instagram rabbit hole, and now I'm following an English guy who spent $100,000 to make his face somewhat resemble a drawing of Kim Kardashian. And I'm 99% sure I should get a nose job. And I was on Google last night, and I ended up on WebMD, and I have this rare form of cancer, so I probably shouldn't plan on taking any messages to anyone until my treatment's over. I don't have my dad to remind me of Rowan anymore, so I have to remind myself to take the message to Garcia. I hate that because I miss my dad, and also because I'm lazy. I don't want to learn how our furnace works and why it's broken. It was Aaron's job to set up the Apple TV and troubleshoot all my tech issues, not mine. I bought the bike trailer for Aaron to use with Ralph, but now it's my job to make sure our son tools around the city with a good view of my butt. I'm not an incredibly confident driver, but it turns out I can load up and drive a moving truck on my own. Twice. I mean, I booked it for like the wrong day. It was actually the wrong year. Like, I was the right day, but they're like, you booked it for 2016. And I was like, well, need it now. So, please. And every time I cross something off my to-do list that wouldn't be there if my husband or father were still alive, I feel perhaps prouder than I should for just being an adult. It's annoyingly true, as we find out once we try to have our tattoos removed or find out the boyfriend our mothers never warmed up to is moving out east to join a throuple, that our parents are sometimes right. My excuses usually are stupid. I'm more capable than I think I am, and no, I probably don't have a rare form of cancer. I can take the message to Garcia. It doesn't matter how or why. When something needs to be done, I can goddamn do it. Like, now do you get that one? Was that like more?
A little more.
Yeah, it's just more like, do you just do it?
Yeah.
Like, you just don't ask questions.
You don't want to.
Yeah, you don't want to. Like, you just do it. Like, use it on your children, grandchildren, anyone. Use it on a stranger. This can be my last chapter because don't have a reason. Always have a reason. Okay, when you start a sentence. Tips. Just tips and tricks for you guys. Use them in your life. Okay, this chapter is called Please Like Me. should be pretty obvious why. It starts with a quote from Brené Brown, whose books I haven't read, but I have read a lot of quotes from her on Instagram, which is very similar. Very similar to reading the whole book. I actually found when I like opened the book, I was like, that's a quote. It's an Instagram quote. Like I figured I could piece it together from like Pinterest, and I did. In fifth grade, I ate dog biscuits because my friend told me to. As an adult, I can say something logical like, well, any girl who wants you to eat dog biscuits isn't your friend. But Erin turned out to be a really good friend once she stopped making me eat dog biscuits after school for her own entertainment. Erin also gave me an ice cream cone to reward me for the dog biscuit I ate, so it's not like she was a total psycho. But even better, she liked me. I was in. We were going to be friends for life because when she told me to eat a dog biscuit if I wanted an ice cream cone, I said yes and started chewing. I would love to say that my dog biscuit days are over and that I'm one of those incredibly confident women who just doesn't care if you like her. Women on that list include Beyonce and my mother and, of course, Erin, who I liked immediately even when I was choking on a dog biscuit and who grew up to be a pediatric intensive care nurse and a real-life angel. It does not include me because I'm the human equivalent of a golden lab. I want your approval, even if I don't really like you and I can smell that you are evil inside. The internet is a really great place to hone this skill. There, millions of people who are actually strangers you have never met at all can say whatever they please about you. And even though I know in my heart that nothing ever good comes from entering the comment section, I occasionally take a peek. And it doesn't matter how many nice things people say about you because you know from your middle school days you don't remember them. No. What you remember is the stranger who described you as awful. Cool. Actually, now the one I remember is the lady on Amazon who rated my book lower than she rated an oven mitt. Why do I know that? Because I'm the kind of fucking person who was like, I'm going to see what other reviews she has. And I was like, cool, Cheryl. Well, that oven mitt met your approval. Sorry, my book didn't. I had like a reply open and I was like, this is not like what a stable person does. Like, this is not like, you don't do this. Like, do you think like, I don't know. Like, I just like, just would Michelle Obama do it? No. Then you shouldn't either. Like, that's just a good rule for life in general. But, you know, I look. It's terrible. Or the girl at a sleepover who told you you'd be really pretty if it weren't for your face. She's great. In both instances, my reaction should be like, well, okay, fuck you too. But instead, it's something more like, okay, how can I change myself to make you like me, and what can I do to earn your approval? Because I will do it. Stranger, I will change everything about me to get you to like me, even though we've never met in person, and your comments should have no bearing on my actual life. An obsessive need to be liked is problematic. First, it is not practical. You are not going to get everyone to like you, even if you're a wonderful human. I once saw a kid give a nun the middle finger, and you are probably not a nun. And to paraphrase Brené Brown, again from Instagram, but like whatever, trying to get everyone to like you is time-consuming and exhausting, and it will take up the free time you could be spending with the people who don't need convincing that you are excellent. I know that sounds like something your mom would say, but I am a mom, and your mom and I are both right. I live every day with a reminder of how dumb it is to try to convince someone to like you. I only see it about 3 times a week because I don't shower that often, but on my back is a tattoo. A dumb one that means nothing and wasn't particularly well done by the guy in Brooklyn who was telling me about his hangover while etching an indelible vector image across my ribs. I don't want to get into the details about what the tattoo is specifically, but if you were imagining like a circle of barbed wire around a four-leaf clover over a Chinese symbol for strength with like a dolphin flying over it, you are wrong, but close. Tale as old as time, I got this stupid-ass tattoo to impress a girl. I met Ricky when I met all my other Brooklyn roommates at a party. I had a boyfriend at the time, and we were cohabitating in Queens. It was shaping up to be the saddest, loneliest year of my life. But finally, he let me tag along with him to a party. Red flag. You live with a dude who never takes you out. He's like, I'm going to a party. Bye. And I'm like, I'll just do my nails again. So he did let me come to a party. I met Lauren. Lauren was very cool and thin and covered in layers of jewelry like an Olsen twin, which was very relevant at the time. I was like, wow, I can see all your chest bones. That's cool. She was standing on her deck, chain-smoking Parliament Lights, while I chugged beer after beer and stood alone trying to figure out, like, what to do with my hands. Between drags, Lauren asked me where I lived and with who. When I pointed out my boyfriend, she shook her head. No, we're too young for that shit. You're moving in with us. Us? Like, I was going to be part of an us? Us was two other girls. Sweet Lorraine, who baked and sewed and was beautiful inside and out, and Ricky. Ricky was terrifying and magnetic. For one, she had a tattoo of her own name on her bicep and hair that was dyed jet black. She said fuck a lot, even by my standards, and she had a way of sort of like looking just beyond you while you were talking. I wanted her to love me, and she did, until we actually all moved in together, when Ricky decided she hated me for like reasonable things, like being in the kitchen when she wanted to be in the kitchen, buying food that was similar to hers, cooking too infrequently in our kitchen, or having friends over on a Sunday, which was the day she used to spend 3 hours in the bathroom on an exhaustive beauty routine, the details of which we could only guess, but which seemed to require like a lot of concentration and like silence. We're like, actually, like, I had to take out like what was really happening in there in the legal read. She was like, I don't know, can you prove that? I was like, we knew. I'll tell you all later, off this podcast. In between hating me, she would sometimes decide to like me for brief, sparkling moments of time. She'd stand near me at a bar and, like, not turn her back to me. She'd put me on a funny email chain. She'd sit down on the couch and watch some VH1 reality shows with me and not say anything mean to me. It was great. During the years, yes, years that we lived together, tattoos were really hitting the mainstream, which I know that sounds dorky, but this was right when Amy Winehouse was getting big and full-sleeve tattoos went from being like a sign you were comfortable on the outskirts of society to being the kind of things that like fat dads in Blaine and with cargo pants sport. You know, like you just see one, you're like, oh, yeah, probably a Blaine dad. So one day, when Ricky made an appointment for a new tattoo, I went with her. Really? She said. And I sensed in her a very, very faint interest in me as a person. Yeah, I lied. I've been thinking about it forever. It's totally time. Ricky doted on me for the whole week after I mangled my torso. She brought me ice packs and spread Aquaphor across my back to speed the healing process. And then just as quickly, she was done with me. I think because I did this terrible thing. Like, I had my boyfriend over at the apartment where I paid rent, and he used the bathroom. And rule breaker. Like, deal breaker. No. Like, no, he could not be there. So Ricky and I moved out of the apartment, and we never spoke again. But I have a permanent memento of our time together. It's not quite as bad as getting a tattoo that says no regrets, but the sentiment's the same. The tattoo isn't even the worst thing I've done to get someone to like me. I did eat dog biscuits and started smoking and pretend to be interested in hockey, but it's the most permanent. And while that's a very valuable lesson and a good story for my children to hear someday, this tattoo has got to go. Like most mistakes, it's easy, calm, and long, grueling go. Instead of the instant gratification you get when you get a tattoo, you have one appointment every 6 weeks where you feel like your skin is being hammered with a million tiny nails, and afterwards, things look just slightly different. When it is gone, my skin will still have a little bit of scarring because the tattoo wasn't really done correctly. And because that happens sometimes when you try to undo a permanent change to your body. I'm okay with that because things change and so do people. I can't do everything right and I can't make everyone like me. And Lord knows I can't erase most of the mistakes of my 20s, but I'm starting with this one. Hold on, I'm just getting a call. I'm just kidding. I just want to take a picture of you guys. Is that weird or totally cool? Exactly, it's cool. All right, hold on. Do you guys know? Hold on. Are there any parents in the room who know how to do this? Hold on. I feel like you're all in it. I actually don't know if that works. I bet there's a professional here. I'm just going to do this. I'm tall enough. Yep. Yep, we're just going to do a bunch and I'll print them all. I'll send one to every one of you. Okay, cool. So just like text me your address and I'll put like Walgreens app, send them to your local Walgreens. And then I'm going to go in the front and sign books and hug you. And I took a shower today, so I only smell sort of weird. I'm like 33, starting to smell like an old person. Just happens. I was like, I smell like my grandpa. And I was like, he was like 65 when I knew him. So that's cool. Nobody asked me to say that. So bye.